This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Good evening and welcome. Tonight, in the second of our four programmes, we are looking back on the life and times of one of our most distinguished living Irish writers, who has also made a significant contribution to the shaping of the cultural and artistic life of the state of modern Ireland. Anthony Cronin is a novelist, poet, biographer, critic, essayist and broadcaster. In a parallel career, his vision of the role and the status of the writer and artist in Irish society has led him, as cultural and artistic advisor to Taoiseach Charles Saughey, to play a major role in establishing such innovative institutions as Estona and the Irish Museum of Modern Art. Tonight we're going to focus on some of Anthony Cronin's travels abroad to London, Spain and the United States and the impact these excursions had on him as a writer. We'll also be talking about the Dublin Anthony Cronin portrayed so vividly in his remarkable bestseller Dead as Doornails and the colourful array of literary and artistic characters he knew in the 50s and 60s and how that period has been portrayed and interpreted in the intervening years. I suppose, Anthony Cronin, everybody had to get on the boat at Holyhead and go to Britain at one stage or another, and you went in the early 50s. What were you in search of?
Well, I wasn't in search of anything, really. London was an alternative in those days, and a really rather wonderful alternative, because it had the same language. You didn't require any passport or whatnot. You could literally just hop on the boat. You could have a sudden impulse in a pub on a Monday afternoon and go down and get on the boat at the North Wall. You didn't even have to go as far as the present boat stations. Yeah, and you could, for a very small sum, I think it was 17 in a tenner, you could be in Liverpool the following morning, coming lifts to London. So it was a kind of rather wonderful place of refuge.
What was it about it that was a refuge?
Oh, it was just you weren't in Ireland, you know. For many years, Tom, I have to say, I woke up in various countries, no matter how hard things were, and sometimes they were pretty rocky, I would say to myself, well, at least you're not in Dublin. Dublin was a place that easily pulled. It was a mixture of boredom and intensity, really, in a way. You needed escape valves, escape channels. There was a feeling, certainly in literary circles, that London was the place to be, or to be published, or to be produced, or whatever. But on a much more mundane level, when we went, and it had become we by then, in the mid-50s, I went because literary employment was available there. I mean, I went, like many another, for economic reasons, and because literary employment was available there, which wasn't available in Dublin. And some things about that aspect of life struck you immediately. It was a much, much more generous place than Dublin was. People would put things in your way. If they didn't actually arrange a meeting with somebody, some literary editor or something, they would tell you to use their name when you rang. And when you rang, you were always very courteously received. If you were beginning to publish at all, and you were at all known, people were extraordinarily good about putting things in your way.
Is this unfair, Tony? But I've always felt, from my own experience, that the English are very generous and approve of talent. The Irish are deeply suspicious of it.
I'm not sure that it's a question of what I'm talking about in those days was a question of the Irish being suspicious of talent, the Irish as a generality. Mm. I'm talking really about the jealousies and the pettinesses in the literary community, and the general atmosphere of begrudging anybody any opening or even having anybody else on board this sinking ship, you know. When I worked on the Bell, there was another employee besides me, an old associate of Pather's, Pather O'Donnell's, who had been in jail with them in 1922, and had a very strange line. It was a master and man situation. He was indissolubly bound to Pather, but at the same time, what he didn't say about Pather, morning, noon, and night, he would say terrible things about Pather. He's a character in a book of mine called Life of Riley. It's a portrait of him, and he's saying things about the editor, Prunchius McGonaghy, who's a portrait of Pather in a way. But he was a Dubliner, he used to say to me, "They're all hungry, Tony. They're all hungry."
What were they hungering for?
Well, they were hungering, you know, the potato patch. They weren't going to have anybody else on their potato patch. And really, it was rather marvellous in London, the way people understood that you were looking for work, the way they immediately looked to see if there was anything you might do or whatnot, you know. And this applied all over. I mean, it applied in the Literary Reviews, it applied in the BBC, it applied everywhere. And it was really a contrast to Dublin. But there was also the fact that it was possible to live there. You could live by miscellaneous literary activities in London in a way which you couldn't do in Dublin. And since I never really hoped to live by writing books, I never thought I would write the kind of books that people would buy in large numbers and that would free you from such mundane anxieties. I lived by miscellaneous literary activities, really, and was happy enough to live by them.
What impact did London have on your life as a writer and your writing?
Well, there's a great deal about London in Dead as Doornails to begin with, but there's also a great deal about London in the poems. I noticed myself that line after line or poem after poem has London images in it, not Dublin images. It was much more a cup of tea in a way. There's a poem I came across the other day. My window shook all night in Camden Town, where through the cuttings worked the sibilant engines, pounded past, slowly gasping in the rain. And that kind of thing was much more up my alley than rural images or Dublin images. Dublin and Ireland had ceased to be, to me, rewarding subjects. And I found much more nourishment of that kind in London than I was finding here.
As a writer, it may be possibly easier to write in London because you've no space to write in Dublin because you're living the business of living in Dublin and society was full of people who were constantly writing. And it's a very invasive place. Well, London would have been a neutral space for you.
Well, it wouldn't have been that neutral after a little while. And besides which, every great city, you tend to divide it up into villages. And you become a villager in a particular place. In my particular case, it was Soho, which was a very different place from the Soho it became later. This was pre-strip club, pre-all the rest of it, Soho. But there were the afternoon drinking clubs and evening pub, and there was a concourse, which in a way I found a more rewarding concourse than I had begun to find such whatever concourse there was in Dublin.
Yeah, two of the people you knew at that period in time in London who were very much part of that period were Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon.
Yes, I've always known as many painters as I've known poets, really, and in a way preferred their company.
Why?
I really don't know why, Tom. They give the impression of being calmer and more collected.
And they're not a threat.
well, they're not a threat, no. Deeply, deeply value their activity. Deeply. I mean, much more than most writers do. And I had met Lucien here quite a few times. At one stage, he used to come over quite a lot. And at one stage, I shared a house in Hatch Street with the painter Patrick Swift, and there was also John Beckett, the composer, and myself. I had a room there. On one visit to Dublin, Lucian used to come over there and he would paint in the mornings. So sometimes the two of them would be painting at the one studio. So I had known him in Dublin, you know. Bacon I really met because we were both denizens of Soho.
I met Bacon too. He was quite conscious of his Irish roots, wasn't he?
I never spoke to him about Ireland that I remember. I may have done. Oh, he told me a story about his upbringing once, which I found fascinating, and it was basically this. His father, who was, as you probably know, a racehorse trainer at one stage, in Kildare, they lived in this house where his parents would often go out in the evening and leave little Francis to the care of this Irish part maid, part nursemaid. But she was courting or being courted by a soldier. And Francis was a nuisance. Constantly, he was a very demanding child, constantly asking for this, asking for that, asking for notice. So she took to locking him in a cupboard at the top of the stairs while she and the soldier disported themselves on the couch or maybe in one of the beds of the house, and he would scream and shout and beat and with it and wouldn't admit to defeat and wouldn't be quiet. And of course, the more demonstration like that he made, the more ready she was to leave him there. And he wound up by saying, "I owe a great deal to that cupboard." And you can see that in the paintings, actually. I think you can see it in the famous Six Studies After Velasquez, which was actually also, I think, Eichmann in his glass cage in the court in Israel. But anyway.
Now, for a couple of years in the 60s, you went and lived in Spain in a farmhouse in Andalusia. Why did you do that, and what was the result of it?
Well, Spain was notoriously cheap at the time. You could live very well on £5 or £6 a week, really. And when I say very well, you didn't starve, and you could even employ somebody to do a bit of sweeping now and then. And you could drink. It was largely, I had got an advance on something. I think it was The Life of Riley. And I lived there largely for convenience sake, but I noticed it too plays a pretty large part in the poems. There's a great deal of imagery that derives from Spain. And there was an interesting thing about it. It was the end of the Middle Ages, and I actually saw the Middle Ages, you know. I saw people scratching at the soil with a wooden plough and treading the wine in the old way, and olive presses that went back to the Romans, you know.
Those great religious festivals.
Well, every second day, that was like the Middle Ages too. Every second day in the Middle Ages was apparently a saint's day or a holy day. And the Spaniards were certainly glad to down tools as often as possible. And there was an amazing number of saint's days or holy days which involved not doing any work. But every place stayed open. I mean, you could.
And you had a sense you were actually coming in at the very end of a historical cycle that possibly had lasted 500, 600, 700, 800 years.
Yes, I'm not sure that I had the sense of it ending so quickly as it finally did. I mean, its last vestiges are gone from Spain now. But then it was very much alive. And it was very much alive in attitudes, too, you know.
Like what?
Well, the religious processions were patently medieval. And they were so without thinking of tourism. They were so because they had always been so.
Was there an interesting vista there between traditional Irish Catholicism and traditional Spanish Catholicism?
No. You had the feeling that traditional Spanish Catholicism was something that had been rooted there for centuries, whereas I always had the feeling that Irish Catholicism was a bit ad hoc, that somehow there had been a break. And I believe historians more or less agree on this, that there was a pious revolution.
Post-famine.
Yes, partly post-famine, and partly the rise of the middle classes, and partly the establishment of Maynooth, when Catholicism became not only something to be tolerated, but became an active weapon in the hands of the British Empire. I always had the feeling that it had been got up at a later day, and although my heart brimmed like those of other wee mites when we went in procession through the town singing Ave Maria or whatnot, and the arches were erected for Corpus Christi, it didn't seem to me to be so deeply woven into the place as similar things in Spain were.
Now, at the end of the 60s, and let me deal briefly with this because it was a fascinating moment, you were in the United States virtually for the last half of the 60s, and there you had the killing of Robert Kennedy or the end of the Vietnam War. I think we were heading into Watergate, a moment of huge turmoil in the United States of America.
Yes, of huge turmoil. It never struck me as truly revolutionary, which in some of its aspects in 1968 was in France. In America, it was too deeply bound up with the fear of being drafted among middle-class students. And that fueled the anti-war demonstrations and everything else in a big, big way. I mean, the draft was a very real danger to people. And some of us in Montana, we cooperated in preventing people from being drafted, because if a student got a certain number of A's, you didn't get drafted. So I used to send people over to the art department where the man in charge, sculptor Rudy Altio, used to give them A's, and then he would send fellas over to me who weren't really distinguishing themselves in any of the things I taught. But I would give them a couple of A's to save them from being drafted. But it was a rather strange and marvellous time. I mean, even in backwaters, which to some extent Montana and Iowa were, the fervour that gripped student populations in other states were real enough. It was a time when almost anything seemed possible. With Robert Kennedy, that brief period, that a sense of possibility had entered things, which is not something you commonly feel in the United States, that everything, every attitude was up for grabs, and the change in everything might not be too far away. It was quickly eliminated.
Then you...
Other people must have felt that too.
But then you wonder, and this struck me too, because I also lived through that period, when the present business in Iraq began, one could anticipate it would take the same form as Vietnam. Is the United States a place with no historical memory? No ability to learn from the past? Is there something in the American culture that...
Well, there is a huge difference in one respect, and that is that Iraq is being fought by professional soldiers, often recruited from the lower echelons of American society, who do it for the exit money, really, or the exit degrees or qualifications. And it isn't affecting the life of the middle classes in the same way as Vietnam did, because Vietnam was being fought by conscripts who were, to some extent, although there was all this draft dodging, middle class kids. So there isn't the same attitude towards it.
The body bags were coming home to the leafy hedges, and that was profoundly different.
Profoundly different.
Coming back to poor white America and
yes,
poor black
America.
Yes,
they weren't coming back to Detroit or Chicago the same way.
Now, after all of those travels, Tony Cronin, you then come back to Dublin.
Mm.
I suppose you had to come back? You felt in your soul you had to come back?
No.
Or you reluctantly came back?
No, there was a choice after Spain. There was a choice. We had a few quid, but I wanted to go back to London. We'd been long enough in Spain, and instead of just writing the one book, I had written two, because I wrote most of a critical book called To Question of Modernity there as well as The Life of Riley. But my wife wanted to come back to Ireland. In fact, she had that sort of soul thirst that Irish people do get.
You could have done without it?
I think I could easily have done without it.
You'd escape by then?
And I felt for many years afterwards that it had been an error, a mistake. But, of course, destiny has a funny, hand, which it conceals. The hand of destiny is not of its nature apparent to you at certain times. And I can see in various ways that one was destined to come back. But there is another thing, and that is that life in Ireland has improved. I think I said before the other day that I thought that Ireland now is much more interesting. Whatever else it may be, it's a much more interesting place than the stagnant, deadened life, dark, I think of it as, Ireland of my youth. But other places have disimproved. as Ireland improved as a place to live. When I say improved, I mean with the immense reservations we all have. So that it is improved out of proportion, so to speak.
Now, let me talk now about Dead as Doornails, because it's a wonderful portrait of 40s, 50s and 60s. It's a wonderful portrait of the writer as bohemian and how writers work and live together, and in particular their portraits of three major figures, Brendan Behan, Patrick Kavanagh and Miles Na Coppeláin. I want to start with Brendan Behan. Nowadays, Behan is you know, seen in the same light as Beckett or Yeats, but surely not. Surely, in fact, a minor literary figure.
Well, I don't think it would be true to say that he is seen as in the same light as Beckett or
but
Yeats.
But why does his fame so far exceed his achievement?
Well, he was a remarkable character. I think Dennis Dornhills is to some extent responsible for this. I mean, it's been a strand in this. He was a remarkable fellow. I mean, entirely remarkable in many respects, deeply and truly remarkable. And he made an impress. He also came at a cusp of things when they were changing. And
he hit television, didn't he?
Yes, he hit television, and not only that, but in a way he hit the 60s, you know, the change.
But he also hit the notion of the drunken Irish writer.
He did, absolutely. Well, of course, that had not so much the drunken Irish writer as the drunken Celtic writer had received an enormous boost, not only from the life of, but more particularly from the death of Dylan Thomas. And nothing is sadder about Brendan in the later days than the fact that he seems to be aiming to be a poor man's Dylan, you know.
Yes.
Here, a newspaper's Dylan.
Well, here's a moment from Brendan Behan, and as ever, he never fails to surprise. Brendan Behan in one of the hundreds of different people he was.
Lovely.
But looking back now, Tony Cronin, his literary achievement was very, very small. He was a man who probably wasted his time, did he not?
Well, we all wasted our time, but maybe he wasted more of his than other people did of theirs. Yes, his literary achievement is small enough, but there is a way of living as a person, you know, as a... I hate that word, character, but
yes.
But he does live on as a person, apart altogether from as a writer.
But was there a crisis in that he wanted to perform the life of a writer more than write books?
Yes, I think that's just enough. He did. He was also unfortunate in that his impact had been associated with outrage and drink and errant behaviour of one kind or another. So he had to keep that up, in a way. He had tasted the fruits of the attention it got him, and he was willing to keep that up.
I mean, it's a wonderful portrait of him in Dead as Doornails. There's the wonderful trip to France when, obviously, yourself, Brendan, is in the best of health. But towards the end, Behan becomes a truly tragic figure. And I also have the sense of all the people who colluded in this performance of his life, which ended up in his very early and premature death.
Yes, what can I say? But that's just enough also. There were vast numbers of people in and out of the media, but also in private life, who colluded in wrecking him. But they only had a puppet figure on their hands, really, for much of the last period. They never knew the real Brendan Behan. The real Brendan Behan was somebody to know. That's, you know. I also think there's another thing to be stressed about him. Whatever we say about his failure or his ultimate failure, compared to a lot of what's around nowadays, he was a king among men. He believed fiercely, passionately in certain freedoms and generosities of spirit. Really believed in them, not going through the liberal motions or anything like that. He was warm and brave and immensely rewarding in terms of amusement and exchange of
you and he must have been very close, because not many people knew Brendan and liked him as powerfully and emotionally as you did, clearly.
Well, I'm glad that that's how it comes across. That's yes. how it was meant to come across. Yes. I hoped that both sides of the coin would be there. I've also thought much over the years about the breach between him and Kavanagh, and regretted that I found myself compelled to take the side I did. One thing about Brendan was he always behaved worse under rejection than it was a disproportionate worst. It was more than the rejection probably warranted. And when Kavanagh rejected him, which was really the basic fact of the matter, that Brendan wanted notice from Kavanagh, he wanted esteem from Kavanagh of a sort that he wasn't getting, and he behaved very badly, you know, as a suitor, shouting from a distance and shouting at the object of his own love and affection, if you like, and therefore alienating everybody further. But these things do happen in life, and one thing about the people in Dennis Dornhill's, in that part of the book anyway, they were all to a greater or lesser degree desperate. I mean, Ireland forced a kind of desperation on people, desperate about many things, the basics of living even. But,
interestingly, you say desperate, because reading Dennis Dornhill's talking about Bian Kavanagh and Miles na Gortlain, all of these men were savaged by alcohol in a curious sort of way.
Savaged by, you mean it didn't do them any good? Oh, no, it didn't. I quite agree. Alcohol is a terrible destroyer, though. I mean, I've seen that in my own life, that it destroys possibilities, destroys.
But it particularly savaged this generation, didn't it?
It did, yes. It did. But then that's an aspect of desperation too, you know. I mean, drinking and the ability to handle drink and whatever they say, whatever physiological factors may be involved, is often a result of unhappiness, desperation, thwarted hopes, or whatever. And they were there in plenty to.
But also these people in love, or there were many people in love with the romantic notion of the writer as the drunk. The great writer drinking themselves to death, the association between writing and literature and alcohol.
Well, I wouldn't say that about the principal characters.
No, perhaps not the principal.
No, perhaps Brendan to some extent, but not of Miles or Kavanagh. Alcohol also creeps up with people and says it fills up lives.
you mentioned Patrick Kavanagh there. Let's listen to a poem of Kavanagh's, which I think you'd agree is possibly central to what he was about. It's a poem called Epic. Epic. In fact, you published that.
Yes, in the Bell. I published quite a number of Kavanagh poems. I had an arrangement with Pather whereby when Kavanagh produced a poem, there would be immediate money. Not a great deal of money, but it's a great spur to poetic composition apart from anything else.
Isn't it remarkable now we're in the 21st century? And I have a sense that Kavanagh has outstripped your other three and has had a very large impact on Irish writing, much more so after his death.
Well, I wouldn't say too lightly your other three about Flann O'Brien. Mm. I think in a less... You see, Kavanagh's thing is bound up with a myth as well. There's a personal myth. Whereas poor old Miles, I suppose the life in a way is so depressing. You can't mythologize him beyond a certain point. There was a certain amount of Miles mythology when he was alive. But in
the sense, in that poem epic, Kavanagh is dealing with the great dispute which I suppose dominated 20th century Ireland between the provincial and the parish, and whether we were a small part of the world compared to larger parts of the world, and all sorts of notions of Irish lack of self-belief and self-sufficiency. Epic drives through all of that and arrives at a received wisdom, which perhaps a new generation now are arriving at, that gods do make their own importance.
Yeah, I think you might be amalgamating two or three different things there. Let me say that it has dismayed me over the years the failure to regard themselves as world poets, and in the sense that, say, you know, Octavio Paz is a world poet, or Pablo Neruda is a world poet. It's always the small, personal subject. And I think I said the other day that it's only in times when poetry is feeling rather weak and insufficient to the larger tasks that it becomes entirely personal lyrics, the lyric of personal emotion. And if you look in any Irish collection or anthology or any Irish journal, you'll see that we have quite a lot of that, whereas the great world is there for the poeticizing, if poets are brave enough. And that doesn't mean an abandonment of... You see, it isn't a quarrel between the place being as important as another place, or every place is metropolis. I agree. But metropolis isn't obsessed with itself in the same way as much Irish literature tends to be. And having a larger subject, let's just call it that so that we don't have to get into arguments about the particular and the general, but having a larger subject doesn't rule out the more personal by any means. If you take Picasso's Guernica, for example, he was painting a great political statement. That was what he was making, a great piece of horrified description of the contemporary world. But at the same time, just at that moment, his own personal life was in rather a tangle. He was trying to get rid of Olga. Marie-Thérèse was with child. And Dora Maar had just come along to make things even more complicated for him. And he got all that into Guernica. It's all there, along with the horror of fascism and everything else. A subject in poetry is a funny thing. I mean, a poem can have 20 different subjects. Every line can be about another aspect of things.
Well, Tony Crowley, looking at Kavanagh's work, and the early stuff that... the Georgian stuff, which you might call the ploughman poems, and then that moment in the Grand Canal in the 50s where he undergoes a change of gear, and then he begins to write for a number of years some of the most important poems written in the 20th century, doesn't he? The Canal Bank poems and others.
Well, I think the most important poems, I don't want to make comparative judgments, and I won't be lured into them, but... A qualitative statement like some of the most important poems of the 20th century is something that it takes the mind such a long while to get hold of and to make assessments and comparisons. He wrote some very genuine personal poetry.
But there was more than the personal there. There was also the sense in which he was coming to terms with the island he was living in, and he was coming to terms with the way he had been in his, he felt rejected in Dublin, and the way he was in search of what he calls his truth.
No doubt all that is true, but yes, no doubt. I mean, he wrote some marvellous poetry.
Can I ask you for a moment about The Great Hunger, which he rejected himself, or he said he rejected himself, and looking back now, is that a major poem?
He rejected The Great Hunger for, I think, a complex of reasons. First of all, it was too brilliantly objective. The novelist in Kavanagh, which was always there, always seeking an outlet, but never quite managed it in the what people regarded as a publishable way, is brilliantly successful in The Great Hunger. And he brilliantly imagines an objective circumstance, which mirrors his own, of course, in many ways, but still is outside himself. And I think he rejected it afterwards for the mistaken reasons that it was outside himself. It wasn't part of his personal epic. But who knows? People are often mistaken about their own work.
And we mentioned it earlier, you mentioned it earlier, this extraordinary dispute between Kavanagh and Behan, and you said you sometimes regretted that you couldn't have maybe somehow brought them together or explained it. I mean, what was the root of that?
No, that's
dispute?
Not what I regret so much. My regret is having to take one side.
Or the other?
Yes, and to take the particular one I did. There was a deep antipathy, which I think was based on very deep subconscious reasons on Kavanagh's part. He valued innocence very highly, and he saw himself as the incorruptible innocent. And he wrongly saw poor Brendan Behan as being an urban, depraved, almost sophisticated. And he felt him as a threat to his own fundamental innocence. And he felt a lot of things to be involved. He didn't realise that there was an innocent side to Brendan Behan as well, and that he wasn't at all the depraved, sophisticated that Kavanagh imagined him to be.
And it was ironic that you knew both of them in a different way to how neither of them knew each other.
Well, yes, but that is that's often one of the sad things in life, isn't it? That you know both parties in a different way from their image of each other. People construct imagos of each other, which they put in place of the real.
And so, people fall in love with their own imagos as well, don't they?
They do, of course, yeah.
Now, this is a wonderful description. A small man whose appearance somehow combined elements of the priest, the baby-faced Chicago gangster, the petty bourgeois malt drinker, and the Dublin literary gent. And that is your description of Brian O'Nolan. All the elements are there. How does he compare with the two men we've spoken about, Brendan Behan and Patrick Kennedy?
Ah, well, he's in a different territory, you know. He was a novelist to begin with. And though Kavanagh tried hard enough, God knows, he wasn't a novelist in that sense. And he wasn't a prose writer in that sense, though, like many poets, he could write excellent, sometimes marvellous prose. Nogoplin did things to the novel that were strange and wonderful. He also was a genuinely, verbally funny writer in a way that neither of them were. In a way, insofar as they're funny, it depends too much on the situation or the circumstance. The mere slipping on the banana skin. But in Miles's case, I'm sorry to keep calling him different names.
As he had ordained it. It's not your fault.
He was truly, verbally extraordinary. And that is important too.
What was also different about him, of course, is he managed to hold down a civil servant job, a civil servant pension, and be a bohemian.
Well, I wouldn't say bohemian, you know.
Well, to be in the company of bohemians.
Well, to be in the company of drinkers, like himself, and literary men like himself too, but I wouldn't say bohemian. Bohemian's the last, almost the last thing I would think he was. He was trying desperately to be respectable, normal, and upright citizen who not only paid but forestalled the taxman. And failing, of course, lamentably, miserably in those ambitions, but they were his ambitions also.
It's a wonderful trinity if you look at them, even physically. The Dublin house painter, the Monaghan small farmer, and the civil servant seeking respectability.
Well, I suppose it is. It covers the entire spectrum of Irish life, almost, you might say.
And looking back over those 40 years, and this is the period when you were writing and when they were writing, was there a major literary achievement in those years? Because those are the years since Yeats up to the end of the 21st century. In all of what those people wrote and what you wrote and what others wrote, was there a major representation of literature in the new state?
Well, I think people will find that a lot of writing of great interest has come out of the period. I wouldn't be too worried about the new state or whether it has produced, because I hate this idea of a place or a people producing writers in that way, and it's often conceals our terrible. In recent years we have had these centenaries, these rather, in many respects, awful centenaries, in which we're said to have produced
it's become very
writers whom we either neglected or derided or obstructed or drove into exile and so on and so forth. And in what sense we produced them, I do not know. I think Beckett is a writer of world importance, and all the others have their niche and are important where the English language and its usage is concerned.
Do you see a huge difference in the people writing now and the people writing then?
Oh, I do, and that's people writing now are, for one thing, much more methodical and businesslike about us. There's been a change in this respect. You see, what's often overlooked is that the public lives that people led in the 50s and the days described as in Dennis Dornell's there were being lived all over the world. Writers were living out their lives in the cafe, in the pub or whatever, whereas now everybody has retreated to his own domestic arbor, and it's a way of doing it. It's
an isolation and distance.
It's a way of preserving yourself in various ways, and also they are much more businesslike about actual producing of book by book, but then they're encouraged to be so. There is an apparatus that welcomes people's writing in a way that the writings of the people that we're talking about were not welcomed, were not called forth in any real way by any process. They just did it and hoped for the best.
Anthony Cronin, thank you very much. Join us tomorrow night for the next part in this series.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details, visit rte.ie/radio1.